What's up, archive members? Today, we're discussing one of Australia's oldest and most mysterious cryptids, the Bunyip. The Bunyip is usually described as a creature connected to rivers, swamps, billabongs, and deep water holes, but there's no single agreed-upon appearance. Some accounts describe a shaggy beast with tusks and glowing eyes, while others compare it to a giant seal or a dog-like animal or a long-necked bird-like creature. What makes the legend especially interesting is that it existed long before European settlement. Stories about the Bunyip come along from Aboriginal oral traditions across parts of Australia, though the meaning and description often vary by region. Over time, the creature became part folklore, part cryptid mystery, with settlers reporting sightings, strange sounds, and encounters near isolated waterways. Tonight, we'll look at the history behind the legend, the cultural folklore surrounding it, and some of the strangest sightings ever reported. We'd like to welcome you in to the Ominous Archives. So, welcome back, Archive members. I'm Nick.
And I'm Em.
And today, we're going to be leaving the Western Hemisphere entirely, like we have been for this whole month.
We're going far.
Yeah, we are wrapping it up this month. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wanted to say this week. Typically, we release at the end of the week. It's been a long time. Not even a long time, a long week. As you can see. I said we were leaving the Western Hemisphere. We're heading to Australia.
Big country. Lots of things trying to kill you there. I think of the spiders just off top of my head. I feel like they have crazy spiders. The spiders are huge.
Yeah, I feel like that's the thing with Australia is you think of spiders.
Like the bugs, like the wildlife out there.
Pretty much all the things that could kill you.
Quite literally.
There's an extraordinarily high number of things trying to kill you there.
Yes.
But today's thing is a little different because today's creature isn't just trying to kill you. It's also deeply mysterious, culturally significant, and one of the most fascinating legends I've come across since we've started this show.
Yeah, that's some high praise from you. So what is it?
Okay, so here's the thing that immediately sets the Bunyip apart from a lot of the creatures that we've covered on this show. And this is what hooked me when I first started going through the research. Unlike something like Bigfoot or the Loch Ness Monster, the Bunyip doesn't have one consistent appearance.
And what could you mean by that?
I mean, there's not like a single agreed upon description. The way it looks, the way it behaves, and even what it means, all that changed depending upon the region, the witness, the specific cultural traditions connected to it. And the inconsistency isn't a flaw in the legend. It's actually part of what makes it so interesting.
So it's like if everyone who ever saw Bigfoot just described a completely different animal every time.
Exactly. Some accounts describe the Bunyip as a massive beast with a round head, a long neck, and a bulky body. People compare it to an ox, a hippopotamus, even a manatee.
A manatee? In Australia?
Yeah, why not? Some others give it more human-like features. Some said it had dark fur, some said it had scales, and some said it even had feathers.
Feathers?
Yeah, we're going to get to the feathers. There's a whole situation with feathers.
Yeah, I'm a little concerned about the feathers.
You should be deeply concerned about the feathers. Despite all those differences, there is one detail that stays consistent across almost every account. Whatever the Bunyip looked like, wherever it lived, people were warned to stay away from places it inhabited, especially after dark.
So it doesn't matter what it looks like. The message is the same. Just don't go there at night.
Don't go there at night. And specifically, don't go near the water at night. Because the bunyip is amphibious. It lives in swamps, rivers, lagoons, billabongs, dense reeds, the murky, isolated waterways of Australia. The places that are already unsettling before you add this creature to them.
Yeah, I already don't love dark water. This definitely is not going to help.
But then there's also the sound.
Because why wouldn't there be a sound with these things?
There always has to be a sound. Many accounts describe the bunyip's cry as a booming roar or deep bellow that echoes across the water at night. And early European settlers, people who had never encountered anything like it, struggled to describe it. The best they could do was compare it to a mix between a bull, a dog, and something else entirely that they had no word for.
Yeah, it's a combination that's deeply unpleasant to imagine.
It's a horrible combination. And imagine hearing that across the dark swamp in a country you don't even fully understand yet, surrounded by wildlife unlike anything you've ever seen.
Yeah, I'll pass.
So, the earliest recorded colonial encounters with the bunyip appeared in the early 1800s. Southeastern Australia, mostly. Parts of the Victoria and New South Wales area. And there were newspaper reports from that period that helped transform the creature into one of Australia's most famous legends almost overnight. Stories about strange sightings, mysterious sounds, unusual bones found near waterways, it spread fast.
Okay, but you said colonial encounters. So you're telling me this thing existed before Europeans showed up?
Way before. This is actually really important. The bunyip already existed within oral traditions of Australian Aboriginal cultures long before the European settlement. And in those traditions, it was not simply a monster hiding in a swamp. It was something much more layered than that, which is what we're going to talk about properly in a moment.
Good, because I feel like that matters.
It's going to matter a lot. But before we get there, there's one more detail about the creature itself I think it's worth sitting with.
And what would that be?
Some researchers believe that the stories about the bunyip may have also served a very practical purpose. Keeping children away from dangerous water sources, unstable marshes, places where people could easily drown or get into some serious trouble.
So it's a warning system dressed up as a monster, which I feel like is a reoccurring theme in some of these cryptid stories.
I think so too. And it's potentially that. So when you think about it, it is actually a really elegant solution. You can tell a child, don't go near the swamp, and they may listen. Or you tell them that something lives in the swamp that will get them, and they will absolutely listen.
As a former child, I can confirm the monster version is significantly more effective.
Is it?
Yes, it is.
Okay. I mean, you're the one who goes to... Was it Satansville?
Where did I go?
Satansville? Was that the one?
Slayton.
I don't even know where I got that from.
Yeah. I wasn't a child then. I was in high school. Like, if you told, like, a child me, like, oh, like, there's a monster in the water. Like, don't go in the water. Yeah, I'm not going near that water.
Okay. All right. Just had to clear that up.
The point is, the bunyip strategy works. You frighten the children and it keeps them safe.
Frighten the children and keep them safe. It's a time-honored tradition, apparently.
Globally proven.
It is. So, there's also one more thing I want to mention before we move on to the cultural context. Word bunyip itself. Because here's a detail I did not expect when I was going through this. Over time, in some parts of Australia, it evolved into an insult.
An insult?
It was used to describe someone foolish, incompetent, or ridiculous.
The terrifying swamp monster became an insult.
An insult it became.
So you could call someone a bunyip?
You could absolutely call someone a bunyip.
I mean, I've definitely been called worse.
It's a pretty low bar.
It's a very low bar. I'm just saying, bunyip isn't that bad in the grand scheme of things.
No, it's not. But we are going to talk about the cultural and spiritual roots of this legend now, because I think it completely reframes everything else that we cover today, and I want to make sure that we're going to do that properly.
Yep, let's always do that right.
So, to really understand the bunyip, and I mean understand it properly, rather than just treating it as like a spooky swamp monster, you have to understand something about the spiritual culture and framework it comes from. And that framework, it is called the dreaming.
Okay, I feel like I've heard the term before, but I don't think I fully understand what that means.
So, the dreaming, sometimes called the dream time, is a foundational spiritual framework in many Aboriginal cultures. And I want to be careful here, because this is something that deserves to be described accurately rather than reduced to a simple definition. It describes the creation of the world, these actions of ancestral beings who shaped the landscape, established laws, and created human life. These ancestral figures often took the forms of humans, animals, or beings capable of shifting between forms.
So not just mythology in the way that we usually would use the word.
Whoa. Knocking my headphones off. And that's exactly the important distinction. Because in many Aboriginal traditions, the dreaming is not viewed as a distant mythological past. It's not something that happened and is now over. It remains spiritually present, connected to the land itself, like right now.
So the land is alive with it.
The land is alive with it. The rivers, the mountains, the waterways, they're not just physical features. They carry meaning. They carry history. They carry the spiritual weight that has been there for tens of thousands of years.
And the bunyip sits somewhere inside of that.
In many traditions, yeah. Some interpretations connected the bunyip, or beings like it, to sacred waterways, to spiritual warnings, to places that demand respect and caution rather than just fear. It wasn't always simply a monster. Sometimes it was more like a guardian, a presence that existed to remind people that certain places were not to be treated carelessly.
It's really different from how I think the most people picture it when they hear the word cryptid.
I think it's completely different. And this is where I think a lot of early colonial recordings of these stories went kind of wrong. When European settlers began writing down Aboriginal accounts in the 19th century, much of that spiritual context was lost or misunderstood or deliberately simplified.
Because newspapers wanted a monster.
Newspapers always want a monster. And so the bunyip got flattened into an Australian version of a lake creature. The deeper meaning, the connection to the dreaming, the relationship to the sacred water, the cultural laws tied to those places, got stripped away in favor of something more sensational and more familiar to a European audience.
Which is really a big loss, I feel.
I totally agree. And it's worth acknowledging that Australia contains hundreds of distinct Aboriginal nations and language groups, each with their own beliefs, their own stories, their own relationship to the land. So there were never one single bunyip story to begin with. What Europeans encountered and recorded was already a huge oversimplification of something far more complex and varied.
So when we talk about the bunyip as one creature, we're already kind of technically getting it wrong.
We're already collapsing a lot of different traditions into one convenient label. which is important to keep in mind. And I think what makes it even more interesting is that when you look at the reoccurring themes across those different traditions, even accounting for all the variation, certain things do come back. The association with isolated waterways, the nautical nature of the creature, the connection to disappearances or consequences for those who disrespected the land or break cultural rules.
So even across hundreds of different traditions, the warning is consistent.
That's what it is. The warning is consistent. Respect the water, respect the land. Don't treat sacred places carelessly, and if you do, something will remind you why that was a mistake.
There's something genuinely powerful about that, like the land itself having and like giving consequences.
I totally agree. I think it's kind of like the Mother Nature striking back.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a way of understanding the natural world that is, in many ways, more ecologically sophisticated than a lot of what replaced it. These waterways and wetlands that the Bunyip was said to inhabit, they were being protected by those stories for thousands of years before anyone used the word conservation.
Yeah, I hadn't really thought of it like that.
Which is actually something that comes back in a really interesting way when we get back to the modern part of this story. First, I want to take you to one of the most chaotic and frankly hilarious episodes in Bunyip history.
Oh good, I feel like I could use a palate cleanser after all of that. Not because it wasn't important.
No, I know what you mean.
It was important, and I'm glad that we talked about it properly. It needed to be done, but also...
Also, it's time for things to get a bit ridiculous.
I'm excited for things to get ridiculous.
Good, because we're going to talk about the skull.
There's a skull.
There is a skull. And a head. And a taxidermied fowl.
Oh!
And a whole lot of 19th century scientists making very confident claims that turned out to be very wrong.
This is going to be good.
Okay, so hear me out. The year is 1845, and Australia is in the middle of what I can only describe as a full-blown Bunyip moment.
A Bunyip moment.
A cultural Bunyip moment. Because at this point, the legend has been spreading through colonial newspapers for decades. Settlers are already primed to be had to believe that something strange is living in the rivers and swamps. And then somebody finds a skull.
Okay, where?
Near the Murrumbidgee River. And the skull gets written up in the Geelong Advertiser. It was a big article. There was lots of excitement. And according to reports at the time, the Aboriginal people who examined the remains identified it as belonging to the Bunyip.
So immediately it has credibility from multiple sources.
Pretty much right out of the gate. And the description of the creature that accompanied this article is where things start to get genuinely wild. Buckle up. The Bunyip, as described in this article, had features resembling both bird and an alligator.
Okay.
It had powerful hind legs.
Sure.
Claws.
Mm-hmm.
Feathers across its chest.
Okay, back to the feathers.
We're back to the feathers. And a habit for crushing its prey to death.
So it's part bird, part alligator, part, I don't know, something that crushes things.
And apparently it laid enormous pale blue eggs.
It laid eggs?
Pale blue ones.
The swamp monster laid pale blue eggs.
Enormous pale blue eggs. And it stood over 12 feet tall when upright.
Nick. So that's an ostrich. They quite literally, you literally just described an ostrich.
I mean, it's not an ostrich.
Feathers, eggs, tall, powerful legs. That's quite literally an ostrich.
It's not an ostrich, but I appreciate that analysis.
Okay.
You're pretty good at it. Now, the article spread quickly through colonial newspapers, and for a moment, a genuine moment, scientists and the public started treating the Bunyip less like folklore and more like a possible undiscovered species.
Well, yeah, because they have a skull that was just right there.
There was a skull right there. Physical evidence. And look, in fairness to everyone involved, Australia had already proven itself to be a continent full of animals that defied European logic. The platypus existed. The kangaroo existed. The echidna existed.
All of which definitely does sound made up if you've never seen them.
I mean, echidna, 99.9% sure is what Knuckles is from Sonic. So you have a hedgehog and echidna and a fox with a bunch of tails. But they all sound made up. The platypus was literally believed to be a fake specimen when Europeans first encountered it. Scientists thought someone had sewn a duck's bill into a beaver.
It's fair enough, honestly. I feel like if somebody showed me a platypus and I obviously didn't know that a platypus existed, I'd be like, well, what the hell is that?
Perry?
You're lying. Yeah, but we know that Perry's a platypus. If you didn't know that Perry was a platypus, he would look ridiculous.
Maybe. He just looks right. His little hat. And
he doesn't look right without his hat. It's not Perry the platypus without his hat.
He's also green.
This is true. Phineas and Ferb did have me believing that platypuses were green.
Apparently, and I don't know how true this is, but apparently they have venomous barbs.
Hello? News to me.
I mean, we have a computer right here. We could research it. And we have smartphones. Let's see.
Look it up.
Look at that. Yes, platypuses are venomous.
That's crazy. They are so cute.
Wait, can we also say, I have another thing to talk about. And this is like a side note tangent that like ruined my childhood, kind of.
Okay.
Free Willy.
Yeah.
Is a
whale.
Wrong. He's a dolphin.
What do you mean?
Orcas are dolphins.
Oh, wait. Wait. Like, the black and white whale.
Is a dolphin.
That's not a dolphin. That's a whale.
That is a dolphin.
Orcas aren't dolphins.
We're going to get right back to the smartphone. This ruined my childhood.
It's literally called an orca whale, is it not?
No. It's just an orca.
Well, now I've been lied to.
If my phone says yes, I'm going to be like, what the fuck? No, see? Orcas, or killer whales, are the largest dolphins.
That's ridiculous. So why would you call it a killer whale if it's not even a whale?
I believe that name came from the fact that they figured out how to kill whales.
Huh. That's actually
so it was
wild.
Really whale killer.
Yeah.
And then they...
Yeah, got little... Got crossed in the...
Boom! Wow. Just ruined your childhood, too.
Yeah,
Free Willy
crazy.
Is a dolphin.
That's wild. Okay.
I feel like I need a minute.
Yeah.
I was so upset when I found that out. It's like, are you kidding me?
I was so confident.
I was like...
A whale?
Yeah. I almost did the whole... I almost fell into that, like, Mandela effect thing where we're, like, different timelines and stuff like that because that, like, reactor thing they shut down and we jumped timelines, whatever... That whole conspiracy, I almost was like, it has to be a part of it. Because I swore he was a whale. I'm, like, positive when I was younger, I did a research paper on orcas.
I know you to love that movie. Like, I literally know that you love that movie.
Yeah. I've either just been that big of a goofball growing up and didn't realize it, or...
Well, shit, I didn't realize either, so... Guess we're both...
There you go. You can drop that bomb on somebody.
Yeah,
you can, next person in your restaurant gets a free pizza. They can tell you
tell
what a killer whale is.
Dolphin. So anyway, back to what we were saying. Australia has essentially broken the rules of what animals are allowed to be.
They completely broke them. And at the same time, scientists were also uncovering fossils from massive extinct Australian megafauna. Giant wombats called... Diprotodon. I don't think I can say that fast. So we're going to say it that way. Enormous marsupial predators. They were creatures that made the bunyip seem almost reasonable by comparison.
A giant wombat?
Yeah, figured out wombats. That's another thing. I'm pretty sure it's like a kid cartoon. But, yeah, giant wombats. Like, we're talking the size of rhinoceroses.
Australia just keeps doing it, doesn't it?
They just keep, you know, they say, top this.
They did get my favorite band. It's that,
it's that hold my beer moment.
Yeah, here, hold this.
Never ends well, but they do it. So it never kind of really stops. And those fossil discoveries fueled genuine scientific speculation that maybe, just maybe, some ancient species was still alive somewhere in Australia's unexplored interior.
So the Bunyip skull arrives at exactly the moment when scientists are already thinking ancient giant things might still be out there.
It was like perfect timing for a mysterious skull to show up. And then, just to make everything a pinch more complicated, a second specimen showed up.
Of course it did.
Earlier in the 1840s, slightly before the Murrumbidgee, sorry if I butchered that, skull, a bizarre specimen had been discovered near the Hawkesbury River. And this wasn't just a skull. It was a preserved head, and it got displayed and examined by colonial scientific societies.
Well, what did this look like?
Witnesses described it as grotesque, almost otherworldly. It had fur, an elongated jaw, and here's the detail that really got people, a single damaged eye socket that gave it a cycloptic appearance.
It had one eye.
One enormous eye socket, which combined with the fur and the elongated jaw, made it look like something that absolutely should not exist.
Yeah, I feel like I too would have lost my mind if somebody tried showing me that. As he's showing me that. Ugh. What the heck?
That thing's wild.
Yeah, what are you...
What? I don't even know what it is.
I feel like this one's like the easiest one to like figure. Like,
you guys should tell us
that
what it is.
Sense, I feel.
And we'll post these on the Instagram.
Yeah, I'll unfortunately show you what we're looking at.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's a disclaimer. I mean, it's not gross.
No, it's not
weird.
Gross. It's just weird looking. It's
definitely
kind of
is like a freak show kind of thing you would see.
Yeah.
You would think.
Yeah.
For a time, scientists treated it as a genuine unknown species. They had papers written. There were debates. This thing was taken seriously by the people who were supposed to be the rational voices in the room.
And then?
And then a naturalist named William Sharp McLee took a very close look at it and concluded...
Oh, this should be good.
It was a taxidermied fowl's skull that had been deliberately altered and mounted to look like a monster.
Oh, so somebody made it.
Someone made it out of a baby horse and fur and plaster.
Someone sat down and said, you know what would be so funny? And then constructed a cycloptic horse monster and presented, here you go, scientists.
And the scientists believed it for a meaningful period of time.
I mean, honestly, props to whoever did that. That's very much dedication.
It is a committed bit.
It's an extremely committed bit and makes Fritz Fowler look like a beginner.
It really does raise the bar for
I will never forget
planks.
Never forget the name Fritz Fowler.
No. So various scientists examined it, and the explanations ranged from deformed horse to a calf to a seal. Nobody could fully agree, and someone continued to hold out for the unknown prehistoric creature theory.
Even after the fake horse head situation.
Even after the fake horse head. Which honestly says something about how much people wanted it to be real.
Or how much Australia had already convinced everyone that anything was possible.
I mean, they're both probably true. If you're going to find like a dragon, it's probably going to be Australia.
It's going to be somewhere over there.
Yeah. And here's what I find genuinely fascinating about the whole skull saga. Even after the debunking, even after William Sharp McLee, Mac Lee, called out the taxidermied fowl, public fascination with the bunyip didn't go away. If anything, it got even more intense.
Well, yeah, because this question is still there.
Right. If the skulls were fake or misidentified, what inspired so many stories in the first place? What were people hearing at night near the swamps? What were they seeing in the rivers? The hoax didn't answer any of that. It just made the unanswered parts louder.
Which is kind of like the perfect outcome for a legend. The debunking makes it that much more interesting.
It cements the bunyip as something that can survive scientific scrutiny. Not because it proved itself real, but because the questions underneath it turned out to be bigger than the evidence on the surface.
Fake horse head accidentally made the bunyip more mysterious.
That is an accurate summary of the 1840s in Australia.
Yeah, I need that on a plaque somewhere in Australia.
It probably is. So, from the skull saga, we move into the broader wave of colonial sightings that keep the legend alive through the rest of the 19th century. And then there are some genuinely atmospheric accounts in here.
Great, I'm ready for atmosphere.
So here's the scene. Because I think to understand why these sightings spread the way they did, you have to understand what it actually felt like to be a European settler in the early 19th century Australia.
Paint the picture for me.
Let me grab my brush. You've arrived on a continent that operates by completely different rules than anywhere you've ever been. The animals are unlike anything in Europe. The landscape is vast and largely unmapped. The interior of the country is essentially unknown to you. And you're trying to build a life in places that Aboriginal communities have understood deeply for tens of thousands of years. But because that knowledge is not being passed to you, you are starting from scratch in a place that does not feel like it belongs to you. Pretty much because it doesn't.
Yeah, that's an unsettling way to exist.
And if that already wasn't unsettling for you, you start to hear the stories from Aboriginal communities, from other settlers, about something living in the waterways. Something that sounds like nothing you've ever heard. And you go out at night near the swamp and you hear something. A sound that doesn't match any animal you know. And the darkness is very dark and the water is very still. And?
Yeah, I'm there. I'm fully there. I don't want to be here. I'm still here. Keep going.
All right, so the earliest written appearance of the actual word bunyip shows up in 1818. Reports of a strange aquatic animal seen in New South Wales, and from there, the accounts just start multiplying.
So who's seeing these things?
You got all kinds of people. But the earliest and most interesting source is a man named William Buckley. And his story is remarkable even before you get to the bunyip.
Well, who was William Buckley?
He was an escaped convict. He escaped from a colonial settlement in 1803. And instead of being recaptured, he was taken in by the Wathaurong people, an Aboriginal community in what is now Victoria. And he lived with them for nearly 30 years.
30 years?
Yep. He was learning a language, learning culture, living as part of the community. When he eventually returned to European society in the 1830s, he brought with him stories and accounts from his time with the Wathaurong, including accounts of fearsome beings associated with local rivers and wetlands.
So he's essentially like a bridge between the two worlds of this story.
He's like the most direct from that period. And his accounts have helped introduce many colonists to Aboriginal bunyip traditions. Although, and this is important, those stories were often misunderstood or exaggerated when retold through European newspapers and settlers who didn't have his 30 years of context.
So the telephone game starts immediately.
And what comes out the other end of that telephone game is a wave of sightings throughout the 19th century that are genuinely atmospheric. Witnesses describing creatures swimming through the rivers with only their heads visible above the water, long necks cutting through the surface in the dark, accompanied by those booming cries echoing through the swamps and lagoons at night.
The sound keeps coming back.
The sounds are always there. They just stay. They're like a fixture? No.
Constant.
There you go. Thank you. They're constant. And the descriptions varied enormously.
Enormously.
That's not even a real word. I just made that up right on the spot.
Trademark it.
I should. And descriptions varied enormously. Some witnesses described long necks and dark fur. Others said the creature had large eyes. Some compared it to a dog-faced animal. Others described something more like an oversized seal moving much further inland than seals should be.
Well, could it actually have been seals?
That's actually one of the more credible explanations that historians and scientists have landed on. Seals traveling unusually far inland throughout Australia's waterways, in low light, partially submerged, moving through unfamiliar terrain. The seals seen by some people who had never encountered one before could absolutely inspire some of these descriptions.
And that's somehow both satisfying and deeply unsatisfying explanation.
That's the nature of cryptid explanations. They answer the question while also making the whole thing feel a little deflating.
Yeah, because part of you wants it to be the 12-foot egg-laying feather alligator.
Who wouldn't want it to be a 12-foot feather egg-laying alligator?
I mean, always. What else explains the sightings?
The Australasian bittern gets mentioned a lot. It's a marsh-dwelling bird with a very specific call, a deep booming sound that travels long distances across wetlands at night. And locals, even today, sometimes refer it to as the bunyip bird.
The bunyip bird. It has a nickname.
And accidentally, they invented a monster. And then there are the fossil discoveries, which kept feeding the fire throughout the entire century. Scientists were uncovering remains of prehistoric megafauna across the continent. Giant marsupials, enormous predators, creatures that made it genuinely plausible to wonder if something massive and unknown was still out there somewhere.
So the scientists were accidentally making the legend more believable while trying to do actual science.
Everyone in the 19th century, Australia was accidentally making the legend more believable. It was a collective effort.
Whole continent conspiring to keep the bunyip alive.
Honestly, that's what it looks like from the outside. And I think what makes the colonial sighting period so intense is that it sits right at this junction between genuine fear, genuine mystery, and genuine misunderstanding. These weren't all people making things up. Many of them were encountering unfamiliar environment and trying to make sense of it with the tools that they had, which weren't always adequate for the job.
Right, because if you've never seen a seal out of water and one comes lumbering past you in the dark near a river,
you wouldn't think a seal.
You're absolutely not thinking seal. You're thinking something's definitely wrong.
And to be fair, if you saw a seal that far inland, it also made some questionable decisions.
That seal is also having a bad day.
Genuinely lost and probably not thrilled about it either. So here's what I find genuinely moving about the modern chapter of the bunyip story. Because it could have gone the way a lot of cryptid legends go, faded out, became a tourist novelty, got reduced into a logo on a souvenir t-shirt and nothing more.
The cryptid retirement plan.
The bunyip didn't fully retire. It evolved. And in some places, it evolved into something that feels a lot more meaningful than a swamp monster.
And what do you mean by that?
Modern encounters with the bunyip are pretty different from the 19th century sightings. Nobody is organizing expeditions to capture one anymore. Instead, what you get are reports of unexplained sounds near isolated waterways, unusual wildlife sightings, historical research, and something more interesting, cultural and environmental traditions that have kept the legend alive for a very specific purpose.
Okay, tell me about the sounds first, because I feel like that's where you should start.
Okay, so many modern reports still come from isolated waterways in southeastern Australia, swamps, lagoons, billabongs at night. And what people describe hearing is deep booming calls, splashing, movement in the dense reeds, sounds that seem to come from otherwise completely quiet stretches of wilderness.
And that's the bittern bird?
Sometimes, yes. Most of the time, probably yes. The Australia's bittern, whose low-pitched nocturnal call has become so strongly associated with the bunyip legend that locals have given it a specific nickname.
The bunyip bird.
It's an actual marsh-dwelling creature so consistently mistaken for a monster that the monster's name became the creature's common nickname.
It's one of my favorite facts from any episode we've done.
It's a pretty good fact. And the bittern itself is actually a threatened species in Australia, which adds another layer to the whole thing. The creature most responsible for keeping the bunyip legend alive in the modern era, it is itself disappearing.
Yeah, that's sad, actually.
And other modern sightings getting explained in pretty practical ways. Reports of seal-like creatures or dog-faced animals moving through rivers usually attribute to seals that have traveled unusually far inland. In northern parts of the country, stories about creatures dragging animals or people into the water are genuinely linked to saltwater crocodiles, which are very real and very capable of doing exactly that.
Saltwater crocodiles are doing a lot of heavy lifting for Australian cryptid legends.
They are tremendously helpful in that regard. And then there is the modern research side of things, which is genuinely fascinating. Cryptozoologists and folklore researchers have started digging through Australian newspaper archives on a digital platform called Trove. Maintained by the National Library of Australia, it contains hundreds of 19th and early 20th century newspaper articles about the bunyip sightings and encounters.
So there's a searchable database of bunyip hysteria.
It's a huge database of bunyip hysteria. And the researchers are going through it, comparing witness accounts, looking for reoccurring details, and booming noises, the seal-like descriptions, the long necks, the unexplained movement in rivers, trying to piece together what the pattern actually looks like when you zoom out far enough to see it all at once.
And what does that pattern look like?
Honestly, it looks like a lot of different things feeding into one legend over a very long time. Misidentified animals, fossil discoveries, cultural stories filtered through misunderstanding, genuine unexplained experiences, and specific atmosphere of content that has always had a talent for making the ordinary feel extraordinary after dark. But here's the part of the modern story that I want to make sure we spend a moment on, because I think it's the most important part.
Okay.
In some Aboriginal communities today, stories about beings like the bunyip or the Narangeri Mullywonk are being used actively. Not as horror stories, not as tourist attractions, but as tools for teaching respect for the waterways, wetlands, and natural environment.
Teaching conservation through the legend.
Yep, and in parts of the Fluorio Peninsula and along the Murray River, cultural tourism programs and walking on country experiences incorporate these stories while teaching visitors about wetland restoration, local history, and indigenous cultural traditions.
So the original purpose of these stories, protecting the waterways, respecting the land, is still functioning.
For thousands of years. The warning that was built into this legend from the very beginning, take care of these places, treat them with respect, understand that they matter, that warning is still being delivered. It's just a different form now.
Yeah, I find that really beautiful. Like, the legend outlasted everything that tried to flatten it. The colonial misunderstanding, the fake horse skull, the newspaper sensationalism. And what survived underneath all of that is still doing the thing that it was always supposed to do.
That's exactly it. And I think that's what makes the Bunyip genuinely different from a lot of what we cover on this show. It exists somewhere between folklore and history, cryptozoology, and cultural memory all at once. Its appearance changed. Its meaning shifted depending on who was telling the story. But that core, respect the water, respect the land, understand that these places are not yours to treat carelessly, that never went away.
Whether it's a real creature or not almost doesn't matter.
Because what it's been doing for thousands of years has been real regardless.
Yeah.
And even today, reports of strange sounds and mysterious movement near Australian wetlands keep surfacing. Whether those experiences are connected to wildlife, environmental conditions, folklore, or something entirely different depends entirely on who you ask. And I think that uncertainty is actually the point. The uncertainty is what keeps the Bunyip alive in the public imagination. And maybe that's exactly how it should be.
Don't go near the water at night.
Don't go near the water at night. The lesson endures.
It always endures.
So, before we end this episode, we would like to give credit to Sam, as Sam wrote this episode, well, researched and wrote this episode. And if you are in the mood or enjoy a horror book and want more dark recommendations, go check out her podcast at Scare Me Sam. She does just as good work over there as she does for us, so it's definitely worth checking out if you need a new book. And if you enjoyed this episode, always be sure to follow us at any of the Ominous Archive social media accounts. And don't forget to go check out our store. The link is in our, what is that, Instagram? Yeah, our Instagram description. Feel free to reach out to us. Always rate and review. It helps us out. And I think with all that being said, don't forget to stay weird and stay haunted. See ya.
See ya.